Hello and welcome, everyone. I am Jake Wurzak, and this is Masters of Moments. This podcast features conversations with the top entrepreneurs and business leaders around hospitality, real estate, investing, and company building. Thank you so much for joining me and enjoy the show. You've heard it on the podcast so many times, and I'm going to say it again. Relationships are everything in real estate. At Dove Hill Capital Management, one of the most interesting things about our track record is that the majority of the deals have come to us off market or lightly marketed. So we had this innovative idea a few years ago, and that was to launch the Deal Rewards Program at Dove Hill Capital Management. If you want to learn more, you can go to www.dovehillcos.com. Again, that's www.dovehillcos.com. You click on the little deal rewards icon and you can sign up. And if you have a deal that's off market that somehow came to you, maybe you're working on a deal, you're trying to put it together, bring it to us because we can help you get that deal done through our deal rewards program. We offer industry-leading incentives. We'll allow you to co-invest in the deal. We could come up with another interesting structure to allow you to do the deal with us. The Deal Rewards Program is incredibly unique and will give you an opportunity to do a deal with Dove Hill, either in a completely passive position or maybe you're taking a more active role. Either way, please check out the Deal Rewards Program at www.dovehillcos.com. Appreciate it. And this is how we've been getting our flow. The team at Wurzak Hotel Group is just firing on all cylinders right now. So I am very, very excited and proud to announce that we now have a third-party management program where we are managing hotels for other owners. We used to just manage hotels for ourselves, and now we've made some tremendous forward investments in people, our team, technology, accounting, finance, and most importantly, culture. And we are prepared to bring that out to everyone. Our team is experienced in managing independent hotels, branded hotels. We have focused heavily on boutique, lifestyle, and experiential hotels. And we're ready to manage a hotel for you. So if you are interested, if you want to learn more about what we do and how we can help your hotel, please visit wurzakhotels.com. My conversation today is with John Grossman, the CEO of Grossman Company. They are a diversified real estate holdings, and he's also the CEO and founder of Mark & Rose Hotels, which is a hospitality spinoff of the Grossman Company for their amazing portfolio of boutique and lifestyle properties. This conversation touches everything from how John designs hotels, his service philosophy, how he's able to create those very special moments in hospitality, which we are all seeking. And we even go deep on a 1960s motel conversion that John did, where he added a Nordic spa and just made it totally cool in a resort outdoor destination where there's a ton of opportunity. And I actually think everything that John's doing in experiential travel and really unique stays is the future of hospitality. So I really hope you enjoy my conversation today with John Grossman. One of the reasons I was really excited to talk to you is because you have a hospitality portfolio that is the envy of many hospitality owners throughout the country, including myself. The style is just so good. And I think a good place to start is maybe just to give some of the listeners a little bit about your background.
Okay, great. Yeah, so I appreciate the intro and thanks for the kudos on the portfolio. It's definitely something we've been building over the last 10 years or so. But our focus is primarily in the Mountain West, Intermountain, kind of West, Southwest region, along with the California coast right now. So we have 9 hotels total in the portfolio. That's about 1,350 rooms. And then we have a new standalone restaurant, which will eventually become a hotel once we get through the entitlement process. All of the hotels in the portfolio are independent. We're not affiliated with any brand or franchise agreements. We've got all the infrastructure in-house, sales, marketing, operational leadership, and it allows us to be pretty nimble, pretty flexible, especially when you go through difficult times like we had most recently with the pandemic, of course, and allows us to be a little bit more, I guess, scrappy, if you will, in terms of competition landscape and other things that we're all up against as independent hotel owners and operators. So our hotel portfolio has 2 hotels in Carmel by the Sea, 2 in Laguna Beach, 2 in the Phoenix area, new one up in Flagstaff, and then two properties in Boise, Idaho as well, along with the restaurant that I mentioned, which is actually in Paradise Valley. So that's what the landscape is like today. And, you know, our focus right now is really to maintain a geographic concentration. The purpose for that is really twofold. First and foremost, we think it's the quickest and most efficient path to value creation, because we can have our eyes and bodies on the properties as much as possible. And so we have a mandate to have a direct flight or one flight connection from Phoenix, Arizona, which is where our team is based. And then the second reason is quality of life. So I'm on the road a lot. My team's on the road a lot. But, you know, the goal is to get out there to the properties and back and hopefully do a day trip if we can, or a simple overnight. And so that's really where we landed in terms of keeping our geographic focus to the West and Intermountain West.
Quality of life seems to be synonymous with the West Coast. And you're not the only one, because what happened since COVID is just this really interesting explosion of leisure travel. And it seemed like you were at the forefront of that. So what about leisure and what about independent hotels is so interesting to you?
Yeah, I think, you know, we kind of got lucky in terms of the pandemic and all of the demand drivers that it led to. And I say that because we focused on markets that allowed us to have an independent presence. And, you know, when you find yourself to those opportunities, they really lend themselves to being in markets where you're selling the market, right? So Carmel by the Sea is a place that you select. And then we just fight for your eyeballs as you go on your search path and descend where you want to go. And so it allows us to be kind of in niche markets where we can have an outsized presence. And then on the flip side, you know, our major footprint is in Phoenix, Arizona, where it's a lot of group business. So we've kind of got the dichotomy between, you know, heavy leisure on the smaller boutique side and then heavy group on the larger big boxes that we have. So it's just, you know, kind of a opportunistic view on things. And fortunately enough, it'll let us be in a good position to weather the storm that we just went through. You know, I think all of us were cringing as we went into the pandemic. And then we were very, very pleased to see that the markets that we're in really lent themselves to strong leisure demand, which absolutely floated the boat, so to speak, through the pandemic, and then allowed a real strong snapback as we came back with a lot of the revenge travel and revenge weddings. And I mean, other kind of silly terminologies, but they're true. They were really welcomed a phenomenon for us.
So how did you avoid, in your history of your company, the franchising model? And how did you have the confidence to just do it yourself on the independent side? Because a lot of people are nervous about it. They're saying, well, I'm not going to be able to get financing, or I'm not going to be able to get the eyeballs. So what gave you the confidence to go out and do that? Is it just the location, or is there something else?
Well, as you know, a bit of the history in our company, you're aware, of course, is that it's a family business. So I'm a second generation leader of the business. And I bring that up to say that we had the credibility and the longstanding track record to allow us to get the financing on an independent basis. And I think that ends up being a major hurdle for a lot of independent operators. And that's why you see the proliferation of soft brands. And it makes a lot of sense, right? If you don't have a track record, you need that marketing engine behind you in order to get the confidence from the lending partners that you need, you know, construction and otherwise, to move forward with these projects. So that was one hurdle that fortunately for us was a little bit easier to clear. And then, you know, the other issue, of course, is the chicken or egg scenario with regards to the infrastructure that's required to support an operation like this. And in that case as well, we had the infrastructure, we had enough scale to amortize those costs, and then we could layer on various independent opportunities thereafter. But without the infrastructure, you know, it's really hard to get going. And that ends up being a major hurdle as well.
And when you say infrastructure, what do you actually mean by that?
So we have a centralized reservation system with a team in Phoenix. We have a decentralized sales force in 12 cities across the nation. You know, and those two components by themselves are major infrastructure pieces. And then we have a really great pedigree of operational leaders that have come from, you know, independent-like experiences, of course, Ritz-Carlton and, you know, Four Seasons. I say independent-like in terms of the quality that they provide, the attention to detail, and a lot of things that lend themselves really well to independent operators, and just kind of a DNA that allows our team to thrive, of course, because they're thinking creatively, and then giving them the flexibility to go beyond what's mandated by a lot of the brand standards.
That's interesting. So what about those people makes them a good fit for your company, having been at a Ritz-Carlton, a Four Seasons, maybe there's a Hilton in there? And what have you learned from them? And consequently, what are you teaching them the way of the wise, independent one?
Well, it's interesting. I think it's actually kind of a pull scenario for them, right? I think they were entrepreneurs in spirit, and they came up through a pedigree where they, you know, an institutional framework that allowed them to understand the business and understand the attention to detail that's required to provide great service. But they weren't satisfied, I don't think, in the roles that they were in. And so you kind of get this certain percentage of folks that want to be, I don't want to say more creative, because these other companies are incredibly creative, but a bit more aggressive, a little bit more tenacious, a little bit more eager to kind of bite off problems themselves and solve them independently. And, you know, we open the door for them, they walk right through it. And the folks that have stayed with us really thrive in that environment. And again, because the pandemic's so fresh in mind, it allowed us to be incredibly nimble and overcome tremendous adversity, because they were positioned to have that perspective and outlook and kind of tenacious spirit. And it's just part of the DNA that they have. And then, of course, it propagates itself within the organization. Their internal idea sharing, you know, problem solving, problem making, and overcoming is just sort of this refreshing, exciting framework for them to thrive within.
You mentioned location a couple times. I always stress to my team that it's not always that complicated. It's location, location, location. Do you have almost like a filter or a criteria that you look for when you're investing? I know you said you want to be in the Intermountain West or the West Coast, but once you get there on the map, what are you looking for?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think we've found ourselves kind of having three silos of business at the moment, and we're open to more. But on the ultra kind of high barrier to entry, leisure focused markets, you know, you have places in California like Carmel by the Sea, which actually has a hotel moratorium. So there's already a built-in barrier to entry. And then you have Laguna Beach, which has a de facto moratorium on rooms vis-a-vis the California Coastal Commission and the entitlement process. It's incredibly difficult. And so when you look at some of those markets, they're just iconic locations that have a brand value that is just incredible to leverage. And, you know, to get in is hard, to thrive is difficult, but in those markets in particular, the long-term private equity value creation model is really accretive for us. And so we can be patient. We can say that we have a longer return horizon, and that's okay, because we believe in the long-term value that those brands provide. And so if you look at the up and down the coast, you know, we're focused on places, of course, like Santa Barbara, La Jolla, Encinitas, you know, up in the Central Coast, of course, as well, even into the Bay Area, but in the smaller niche markets that really have the brand value established already. And then on the group side, as I mentioned, you know, it's just high beta markets. Phoenix is a perfect market for us. You know, we always talk about Phoenix being like a snake crawling up a hill, right? It dips and it boosts and dips and boosts, but it's always in a very upward trajectory. And that's, you know, benefited, of course, by a tremendous demographic profile, which has only been boosted even further by the pandemic. And then the third branch of business that we've just dipped our toe into is kind of this, it's definitely inspired by the graduate model, but layering on kind of the Intermountain West disbursement of in-migration. So Boise, Idaho's tremendous beneficiary that absolutely fit in that category. We just went into Flagstaff. We've got our eyes, of course, in markets in Montana like Bozeman and Missoula. So they're places that have, you know, sizable population to begin with, then a university, and then some ancillary drivers, whether it be a national park or recreational opportunities, you know, access to nature and beauty. So Bend, Chico, Missoula, Bozeman, Eugene, places like that you can kind of see your way through to layering on a really nice leisure experience and then tapping into some of the demand drivers, as well as some of the group opportunities that are afforded in markets. Like, for example, Flagstaff is a Western regional headquarters for Gore Technologies. It has NAU. It has a major USGS presence. And then you have 2.5 million visitors a year passing through Flagstaff to get to the Grand Canyon. And we were the first, I guess, design forward boutique hotel to enter the market. And so far, so good. So we just seeing those opportunities, and that particular brand we'd like to roll out in some of those, you know, Mountain West target towns that I mentioned.
I want to come back to that, because that one is just so applicable for a lot of folks and a lot of listeners, because it seems very attainable. The location might not be attainable for everyone, but what you did seems like, yeah, maybe I could do that, but no one can really do that. It's really hard. So when you're in these locations like Santa Barbara, Carmel, are you just overpaying for this stuff? Are you getting in with some brokers? How are you finding these things in a place where there's a moratorium on hotel rooms, or by legislation, you effectively can't build a hotel room? What is the secret there?
Patience. You know, sure, we'll have to overpay, or there'll be a moment in time where it feels like you're overpaying. But most of all, it's patience. And we just know that we aren't going to, you know, hit many. The ones we hit will be highly scrutinized. You know, this really difficult to access off-market opportunity stuff really never comes to pass, right? I think those are just like super rare, and they occupy, you know, outsized headspace in people's minds, but I just don't think they happen that often. People are too sophisticated. Even the mom and pops that have had it in their family for 2 or 3 generations, you know, they're hiring first-rate brokers and going through a normal process as far as we have experienced. And so, you know, in those markets, once we're able to plant a flag of size, of scale, so in Laguna, our first hotel was 70 rooms. Our second hotel was 36 rooms, and our third hotel could be 12 or 20 rooms. And that's because we're able to have the infrastructure. We can, you know, afford a really high quality GM who can then be an area GM very quickly. And we can run, you know, multiple hotels as if they're one hotel, because the markets are so small and the geographies of those hotels is so proximate to each other that they can easily be serviced by a great high quality team. But you, for us at least, and this is not rocket science, of course, getting in with scale is the most important litmus test for these markets. So if we were to go into Santa Barbara or into La Jolla, you know, we'd have to enter the market with something that had enough scale or high enough RevPAR to afford a really high quality GM.
Okay, so does that mean layer,
yeah.
So does that mean then that you're not going in and buying a 30 room hotel as your first investment in a new market, that you really have to start with, let's say, 70 plus, and then maybe you're layering in on top of that with smaller hotels as they become available?
Exactly. Or it might be a small portfolio buy. So maybe in Santa Barbara, there's 2 hotels of 30 or 40 rooms each, and you buy them both at the same time. Doesn't happen very frequently, but absolutely, we need to go into the market with something of consequence, and then we can back ourselves into smaller opportunities. And so in Flagstaff, you know, we've got our eye on 2 hotels in particular that we would never be able to buy as an entree into the market. But now that we've got the infrastructure with a 125-room hotel, it's in our scope, and we can maybe overpay a little bit, right? And we can find our way to that opportunity that is, you know, not necessarily economic for other folks to come in for an opening foray.
And when you go into a market like that, where you start to maybe see a vision of a cluster, is each hotel going to be a little bit different? Or are they just going to be more of the same of what the original is? Like, are you going to do maybe a more outdoor-focused budget version? Are you going to do more of a luxe version? Or are you going to do more of a hostel version? Or are they all just the same?
Yeah, I think the buildings tell you what they need to be. And so in Flagstaff, for example, we have this 1962 Howard Johnson, which is very much lending itself to this idea of the High Country Motor Lodge, which is the brand that we created. And if we find other buildings like that, then we can apply that brand. Now, in Flagstaff, again, there's a couple of hotel opportunities. One would be a true kind of small-scale mom-and-pop motor lodge, which we could lend, we could layer on some nice design and make it feel really bespoke and intimate. And the other one's kind of an older, you know, smaller room typology building, which might have a combination of some hostel-like rooms and some more traditional hotel rooms. And, you know, I think that market itself is relatively low rated. So there's not going to be a huge spread in the opportunity to kind of slice the profile of those experiences, but they'll be different enough and we'll kind of lean into the building in ways that feel really appropriate and germane to kind of the sense of what we think should be there. I think that's, as a general comment, one of our company mantras is don't fight the building. And so what we mean by that is look at the bones, understand the bones. If it's the right opportunity, then lean into what's there. As opposed to being additive, we try to peel everything back to what we believe the essence of that experience should have been or always wanted to be. So we talk about not fighting the building, and then we talk about the concept of telling the lie that tells the truth. And so what I mean by that is, what is the true essence of this experience, and how is it that we can build a white lie around it to lead you to feel a certain way about what you think might have always been there, but that has newly arrived vis-a-vis our design overlay and conceptual pillars, but really trying to find what the essence of the place and the space always wanted to be. And that's really where we start with any of our opportunities.
All right. So I really want you to break down the underwriting side of your analysis on this Flagstaff deal. How do you have conviction to do a deal like this in a new market? Break it down.
Yeah. So this, as I mentioned earlier, the Flagstaff market is a relatively low rated market, but a very high occupancy market. And that's to do with the demand drivers, you know, that we mentioned: Grand Canyon, NAU, Gore Technologies, good old fashioned road tripping has always been strong on Route 66, of course, as well. And in this case, the hotel that we unearthed had great physical attributes, large footprint, lots of open space to utilize and reconceptualize. But at the end of the day, I mean, it was nearly falling down. Older vintage building, hadn't been looked after super well. And as a result, was doing about, you know, $40 ADR, but at very high occupancy, it was around 92% at the time. And we said, look, we can recreate this experience in a way that is nostalgic, that is resonant, that meets the desires of a lot of the leisure travelers now that are they're hitting the road and that are rediscovering the West. And in doing so, we were able to home in on a couple of the market leaders, and we were seeing that the ADR that the top tier of the properties and market were doing is actually about $120 a night ADR. And so, you know, big gap for us to go from $40 to $120, but that was the opportunity before us, and that was the risk that we took. And so the benefit of taking such a low-rated property with so many difficulties to a higher rate, of course, was we were able to buy it very well. And so the investment in the property was more than double the original cost. So our renovation budget was around 110 or 15% of the original physical cost of the existing asset. And so it was a major lift. We touched everything on the property, but we retained the essence of the Motor Lodge experience that we inherited. Again, not wanting to fight the building, we celebrated the building, but we then layered in aspects that made it more of an experience that we believed it represented and that we thought that the consumer would resonate with. And so that included adding a suite product, which was three tiny houses. You know, the tiny house craze is strong. You've got comps like AutoCamp and Under Canvas, and I can't remember the other tiny house.
Did you look at doing that? Adding some AutoCamp style campers or some tents?
We did. We talked briefly with AutoCamp about it, but it was just too small for them. So we ended up just building our own. We have three tiny houses, which are the suites. And then we built two additional tiny houses, which ended up being this Nordic spa component that we wanted to create. So this is two private saunas, rented by the hour. They have private courtyards with an outdoor fire pit, cold plunge, hot tub, and you find yourself to a Nordic spa circuit where you kind of go through this thermal experience from hot to cold. with resting time, you know, in between around the fire pit with.
Do you have a cold plunge?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
What's the temperature?
So the cold plunge is actually our unheated pool. So in the winter, it's very, very cold. And in the summer, it stays cold. And then we also have one of those bucket showers, like the high volume overhead pool showers. So that's kept at very, very cold temperatures. So between the cold plunge and the cold shower and then the hot tub and the sauna, you know, we actually conceived of that with the idea that if you're passing through Flagstaff and headed to the Grand Canyon, you're focused on being in the outdoors. We also recognize that Flagstaff is a grittier, you know, more authentic mountain town and not known for its hospitality experiences. But what's right next door, of course, is Sedona, which is very, very well known for high-end luxury hospitality experiences and spas. And so it was actually this kind of like idea to thumb our nose a little bit at Sedona and say, look, we're not you. We're never going to be you. And we know that people who are coming through Flagstaff want something different than Sedona. We did not try and replicate what was on offer there. And so the idea of this Nordic spa was to really be outdoors, indoor, outdoor, and have it be kind of rustic and fun and casual and convivial, and to have a private sauna that, you know, fits you and your five friends, and you come out of the Grand Canyon, or you come down from a day of skiing at Snowbowl. You know, it's just this fun kind of unique way to still find yourself in the outdoors, but have it kind of in a convenient and high touch hospitality experience nonetheless.
And are you figuring out who your guest is when you're underwriting the deal from the start? Or is that evolving when you bring in a design team and you start going through what you want it to be? And how do you even figure out what you want it to be? Like you talked about Sonoma, but or Sedona, how did you even know that that was going to be the strategy?
It's emergent a little bit. I think in some ways, you know, we understand enough of the demographic profile of who is already coming there. And then we're taking some risks to say, we want to self-select in new visitors to come and visit us that in some cases may not have found the opportunity to even stay in Flagstaff. So for example, with Snowbowl, you know, that's the nearest ski resort to Phoenix, Arizona, which now has about 5 million people in the metro area. That's a 2-hour drive. And people were typically doing day trips or staying in some of the hotels in Flagstaff. But if we just get a small percentage of people who now see us as an opportunity, as a great place to stay to support, you know, their ski trip that weekend, I mean, it doesn't take much to fill up 120 rooms when the ski hill's getting, I don't know how many thousand visitors a day on a weekend. And we really wanted to, you know, provide a different experience, something that didn't exist in market. So on the one hand, it was a risk. On the other hand, it felt like low hanging fruit. And then as we layered in kind of the design concept, things like the tiny houses emerged as a way to have a suite product, like a higher cost, higher touch experience. And then the Nordic spa came thereafter, which was to say, you know, this is kind of a marketing opportunity to have something that's really easy to understand, unique, not necessarily common experience that you can find in other places, but that makes a lot of sense for this particular hotel in this particular location. And that's a lot of what we do. You know, the joy, of course, of doing a different concept or a different design experience in every hotel allows us to lean into the various aspects of what we believe should be on offer and what that folks want to experience. And it also makes it more difficult and costly and time consuming and all the things that, you know, we have to kind of slightly reinvent the wheel every time. I think in the long run, it's where we have the greatest pathway towards true value creation, and these kind of unique bespoke experiences resonate.
And on a deal like this, who's designing it for you? Do you have an in-house team? Are you working with outside designers?
We don't have any in-house team. And I always work, I mean, one of my favorite aspects of my job, and you and I have talked about this, is kind of understanding the design landscape. You know, at the top of the design pinnacle, it's a very small ecosystem, right? There's a lot of designers, a lot of great designers, but it's pretty rarefied air near the top. And having those relationships established maintaining those relationships over time, and then being able to approach a high quality, high rate design team for a given opportunity is a significant portion of what I do day to day, and significant contributor to the value that we're able to create. And so in this particular case, this was a designer that had 7 years at Avroco and then 2 years at Soho, and had started her own firm. And so it was perfect timing. This was her first hotel project on her own, and one where I knew she was going to pour her heart and soul into it. And she also was from the mountains. She grew up in Park City, so she understood what it meant to be in a mountain town. So it was just kind of a great confluence of factors that led us to working with her. And she absolutely knocked it out of the park and was the right moment in time for us to work together on this particular opportunity.
I think I'm getting it, because we've talked about this, right? And there's so many good designers, but those good designers have gotten so expensive. And I was wondering, on a small project like this, how you justify that expense, how you work it into the overall budget. So is that something that you've done before, found an emerging designer and maybe taken a little bit of a risk, but overall it works and you know the design's going to be great. You might have to work a little harder. You might have some challenges along the way, but at the end of the day, that's what you have to do to get it done. Is that the thought process?
Especially on these smaller deals that could not support, you know, the exorbitant design fees that the ultra top tier now command. I'd say that she's obviously going to be moving into that trajectory. I mean, that's obviously her goal, but, you know, again, it was a moment in time where it was a mutual opportunity to do something great, for it to be scrappy, to be bootstrappy, and all of the things that it needed to be, but to be a very high quality, high level design expression, you know, that was in her DNA through the experience that she'd had with these very reputable and high quality firms that she'd been with previously. So I think that was a moment in time. And we've done that elsewhere at Hotel Carmel, for example, which is a 30-room hotel in Carmel. We worked with another emerging designer that had just broken off at that time and started his own firm. And so it was the same kind of circumstance. But, you know, I find it a struggle to keep tabs on who's moving, when they're moving, having known them at a previous design firm and then having them go out on their own. It's tough. And, you know, I always admire folks that are able to find that inflection point and leverage that kind of hungry moment in time that is launching careers. So it's not always attainable, but in this case, it worked out well for us. And it's just something that you kind of get lucky with.
So on these new hotels that you're doing, you have to prioritize certain things because of budget. What are you prioritizing now going forward? And what are those decisions that you're making to make the project better? And maybe you're going to sacrifice something else. What are some of those items?
Yeah, I think limiting construction as much as possible is essential, right? So we really practice the mantra of, like, again, don't fight the building. What does that mean when you're actually getting into the nuts and bolts of construction? That means some cases, or mostly all cases, never move a wall, right? Y'all want bigger bathrooms, but we just can't move walls. And so we live with what we have. We all want new bathroom tile, but in some cases the tile's good enough and we can just regrout. There's these major cost hurdles that sometimes seem essential, but you have to, I think, squint your eyes and realize that the thing you hated most, or the thing that was most difficult about leaving alone, can be less of an eyesore once everything else is done. And you have to trust that your audience, your guest, will either understand and appreciate the fact that you left it alone, or other aspects of the project that will be nice enough or beautiful enough that it allows the tapestry to elicit an experience that is acceptable and enjoyable and beautiful in a way that, you know, again, the constraints, a lot of these constraints too, we talk about being benevolent obstacles. And if you look at them that way, then it makes it a little bit easier to move past these things that you think are just abhorrent and unacceptable. I will say, I do admire, I just went and checked out the new Pally House in West Hollywood. And I do admire the work that Avi Broch does. I believe he does that as well as anyone I've seen. And in the last few projects of his that I've toured, he has left alone the bathroom tile. And he's added other design elements within the bathroom that help subsume the tile itself. Well, at the Pally House West Hollywood, he actually did something I've never seen before, which I plan to appropriate when it's the right time to do so. But he put up a residential curtain on the shower glass door that was kind of tied back with a bow and that could actually be slid across. It was on a traditional curtain track. And what that did was just take your eye to the curtain and this kind of beautiful gathered curtain and obscured, you know, the first look that you have in the bathroom at this kind of older bathroom tile. And it just made it kind of fade into the background. And then he also put in some really interesting kind of traditional Richwood looking kind of beadboard around the whole bathroom wall itself. And so those two elements, which are relatively low cost, I mean, certainly a fraction of the cost of redoing the bathroom tile, made it so that the overall bathroom experience was totally acceptable and beautiful. And I thought that was a very clever use of design dollars, as opposed to what I would do, and many of us would do, is look at the bathroom tile and say, we can't live with this, we got to rip it out. And, you know, that can be $10,000, $15,000 a room right now, maybe more. I mean, it's just ridiculously how expensive that can be.
It is so ridiculous how costs are right now. And it's these little ideas that really bring to mind some of these geniuses in the boutique and lifestyle hospitality space. Talking Barry Sternlicht, Avi Broch that you mentioned, Andre Balazs, Schrager. What separates these folks, the geniuses, from those that are very good?
Well,
other than shower curtains.
If I knew that, you'd put my name with that list of people.
can identify it. So what are you seeing in these hotels that they're getting right?
Yeah, I it's a great question. And I think there's certain people that have this tremendous capacity for right brain, left brain expression, right? And I think Barry Sternlicht would be a great example of a right brain, left brain guy who has it all. You know, he has design sense, he has a business sense, and he's got the aggressive nature within him to action on a tremendous scale and just really remarkable kind of market leading ideas. And so I just think it boils down to these special folks that have the ability to tune into the business imperatives and the design imperatives that come together in a concoction that is a force multiplier for value creation of these deals. You know, I also think that there's a lot of smart things that they do, right? I mean, the Avi Broch example, of course, saved a lot of money. I remember going to the Public Hotel in Chicago. I think that was the first Public Hotel, which is no longer. But I went into the rooms there, and you know, the common areas to begin with are so beautiful. It was such a beautiful kind of Schrager-esque job, and the restaurant, everything about it was just such a wow. And it was so overwhelmingly beautiful that by the time you got to your room, you know, the residual effect of that first impression allowed you to forgive the limited scope of work that they did in the guest rooms. And he basically painted the whole room white. He left everything alone, had very, very limited FF&E and like these tiny little pictures that were just bizarrely small, but something about the way that they were allowed to breathe on the walls kind of made them appear bigger and more impactful than they were. And it was just these tiny little touches that made you feel like these rooms are just fine. Like, I feel fine in this place. I feel good in this place. It's elegant. It's clean. It's simple. But it was stark comparison to the common areas and the overwhelming kind of impressive nature of the arrival experience. And so I think, you know, understanding where to be restrained, where to overwhelm is a really, you know, interesting and difficult to put your finger on value creation technique that these titans of the business were able to understand and lean into.
So are you prioritizing in a lot of your properties, the public spaces, over certain guest room decisions, because in the guest room, the costs just multiply out? Or do you not necessarily think that way?
No, absolutely. I think it depends on the rates that are achievable. But for example, at High Country Motor Lodge, we had to be very, very, very restrained in the guest rooms. And we'd leaned much more into the common areas. And, you know, it allowed us to be more efficient with the spend. You know, we have like fiberglass shower pans, you know, and simple subway tile. And that was as much as we could do in the bathrooms. And then we applied some, you know, interesting beadboard and other elements in the guest rooms. Again, really simple, straightforward, but paint and some tactile layering went a long way there. And we just cleaned it up and kind of took the opinion that this is a room that needs to function well. It can be very simple. It can be restrained, but that most people want to spend a lot of their time either in the Nordic spa or the hot tub or in the common areas. And, you know, we've got a beautifully oversized lobby that has lots of different nooks and crannies and different places to spend a lot of your time. And the room itself can be used for sleeping and showering. And the rest of the time, you kind of want to be out and about with people. And I think especially during the, you know, post-pandemic era that we're in, people want to be around other people as much as possible, as long as they feel comfortable in doing so. And we're seeing that project at least benefit from that desire at this time.
So now, are you designing your hotels going forward in a more community-oriented way in the public areas, in the outside areas, to leverage that trend that you're seeing?
You know, I think when we started moving into the boutique space, we were very F&B averse. And I think that we're still very cautious about trying to be too much, to be too heavily focused on F&B in terms of understanding the risks associated with food wastage and food costs, but also labor costs and the things that go into, you know, very high-end food and beverage offerings. And so, you know, we keep very close eye on keeping a very simple and efficient offering on the actual food and beverage side, but making sure that those things are really, really well done, kind of doing less, but doing them better is a mantra of ours. And then focusing on the spaces to compel and, you know, energize folks to linger and spend time and feel comfortable and confident that, you know, it's just that you don't have to be eating and drinking the whole time in these spaces. We want them to be places for the in-between moments. And I think that's where the design becomes super valuable. And I think that's the balance that we try and find, because we understand how difficult food and beverage is. And we do everything in-house. We do it all ourselves. We haven't done any partnerships. Someday we will, if it's the right opportunity, of course. But at this stage, that's one of our own internal benevolent constraints that we stay focused on.
John, I think that's a contrarian view, because everything I tend to hear and see is the focus and the emphasis and the effort that people put into these elaborate F&B outlets in their hotels, whether it's a bar or a club or a restaurant. So what are you doing to avoid that? How are you creating these moments? The podcast is called Master of Moments. How are you creating these moments without such a heavy emphasis on the F&B component in a lifestyle hotel?
Well, it's a risk. And I find myself wanting to be competitive and looking at folks who are doing great food and beverage experiences and wanting to be that. And I love that for myself. I'm drawn to that as others are. And it's hard, right? It's hard to view it as a benevolent constraint. And it's hard to say, this is what we're good at. We're going to deliver what we're good at, and we're going to stay in our lane. And in doing so, as long as we can deliver very high quality experience within our lane, then we believe that it's an acceptable experience that's going to be additive and accretive in totality for the project itself. But it is hard to do that. I will say, for example, in Flagstaff, we developed a menu around the idea that every component of the food and beverage experience should be trainable in a very short period of time and have the least moving parts possible And that goes for food and the beverage. I mean, right now, you and I could get trained up on the beverage program and we could be bartenders there this evening. And we could do a great job because we have tapped cocktails. We have specialty cocktails that have, you know, three ingredients or less. We have a very limited selection of specialty cocktails that totally resonate with the experience. We've got a bunch of Boilermakers, which are obviously just a shot in a beer, but they're conceived of in a way that supports the overall experience and really makes a lot of sense. And so that's really our goal when we layer in the food and beverage, to make it resonate and not feel restrained when you experience it, but you know, be thoughtful about what we put in so the throughputs are minimized as much as possible.
So I'm really interested in your secret sauce, because this to me is a very big differentiator from a lot of folks. And I'm curious if there's more. I'm wondering, is there a variable or something that you consider when you're analyzing a new investment that would surprise some of the listeners?
I don't necessarily think so. I think to your comment earlier in this discussion, with regards to the simplicity of real estate, right? Like, location is the most important thing. We all know that. So if you take location as kind of a key pillar of our litmus test, that is, you know, where we start and stop our opportunities. And then we just really focus on remaining as simple as possible through the process. And simplicity is very, very difficult to do. We spend a tremendous amount of time trying to figure out how we can deliver on the simplest experience possible. But keeping that focus in mind is what really leads us to these outcomes that are valuable, that are creative, that are sustainable. You know, and because we have such a long-term investment horizon, it has to be sustainable. These are not, you know, brand endeavors for the sake of building a brand. These are endeavors for the sake of long-term value creation, because we have the staying power to stick with these deals for the long term. Our portfolio is intended to be owned and operated in perpetuity. And that's a little bit different.
What does that mean? Because most operators are underwriting to a 5 to 7 year hold period. So how is your strategy so different, and why is that your approach?
Principally, it's to do with our capital profile. So we invest all of our own money in our own deals. We have a limited pool of other private investors that invest alongside us, and our horizon is indefinite. You know, we can look at a longer term return profile. Obviously, it needs to be a very good return profile. It needs to be market rate, but we can find our way to those kind of long term IRRs, if you will, even though we don't really use that as a metric because we're not selling. You don't need IRR if you don't have an end date in mind. But our cash on cash return profile, you know, typically starts slower, but it can ramp up pretty dramatically later in these projects. And then, you know, our attention to detail and our proprietary ownership preferences allow us to continue to enhance the projects as we go. And that, I think, speaks to our geographic focus. You know, if we can be there a lot, we can see the opportunities to improve or fix aspects of the project that need to be fixed preemptively, or in a way that continues to allow the property or the experience of the property to evolve. So there's not a fixed moment in time where these projects are done. You know, we've got our initial push to get it to what it needs to be with the new brand or the new concept, but then we're constantly servicing the experience. We're constantly layering on new programming opportunities. We're constantly looking at the competitive landscape and saying, who are we now? You know, we know who we are, but how do we become more of who we are in the marketplace, and how do we maintain our presence? In the Scott Resort, for example, is now, I guess, going on 5-6 years, and the market has become even more competitive, and it's even more noisy and more difficult to be a prominent experience in Scottsdale. And we're layering on more and more interesting programming. We're enhancing the offering that we have. You know, we know who we are, and we have a great team who really understands what we offer, and then we let them tell us what we should do more of. We have programming there like 5 nights a week now. You know, we started the project with only 2. Now, it's not you know, crazy spend programming, but it's programming that resonates with the locals, and the locals are incredible word of mouth referrals for business. They're also people that make the space feel good. And so keeping it energized, keeping it fresh, we've got a really interesting bar cart series where we do specialized meals twice a month. We've got a monthly rum, it's called the Rum Society, where we have rum makers come in and do a specialized meal. So just allows our culinary team to, you know, shine and have kind of bespoke, interesting one-off meals. And then it allows them to keep focused on what we do really well, which is our standard menu. So it just, by keeping ourselves and our team energized and excited about the experience at the property, it leads us to the ability to communicate that to our guests, and that they keep interested and energized about the experiences that are on offer.
I'm starting to see the magic now, because I think one thing that so many people get wrong is they invest the majority of their capital in the physical, whether it's landscaping, the building, the guest room, the public areas, adding a new restaurant, but then they don't support that manager, or they don't manage it right. They don't invest in the programming. Is being vertically integrated your most sought after competitive advantage, do you think? Could you do this if you weren't managing your own hotels?
And that it's our biggest advantage and our biggest liability, you know, because it's such a heavy lift. It is so much work and it takes so much time and effort. Luckily, it's what we love to do, right? I mean, wouldn't be able to do this if you didn't love it and you weren't surrounded by a group of people that love doing it. Because at the end of the day, managing hotels is hard. And I take my hat off to professional managers. And these folks are really in it, right? It's a passion. It's a craft. It's not just a business. You know, it transcends business into a way of being and a way of seeing the world. So the vertical integration allows us to be really nimble and change. And I hate the word, we don't necessarily pivot, but we iterate. And we can just do things and experiment with things very quickly and have immediate feedback that we can then talk about and debate. And the one other thing I would say, in addition to kind of the vertical integration from a property management perspective, is the commitment that we make as a client to our designers. And so I think if I were a designer, I'd be really frustrated to do a project, create this beautiful thing, take photos of this moment in time when it had just been completed and it looks exactly like the design team had intended, and then to come back 2 or 3 or 5 years later and see it fall apart, right? And our commitment to the design team is that we will work very, very hard to create these design pillars and concepts that can be brought to life physically and then actually grow beyond their initial expectation through the attention to detail and consistent enrichment that our operational team can layer in. And so that is a point of difference, not only to how these properties live and grow in the marketplace, but a point of difference to our commitment to the design team, that they know when they work with us that we will really, truly fight to keep their vision alive and to delight them as they return to the property to see how much more it could grow into than they had previously even thought of, for example, when the project was being scripted in its infancy.
How do you and your operating team know how to continue the vision in the right way, or to mold the vision to what the right way is? Are you there 5 nights a week picking the entertainment, or are you kind of setting the guardrails and your team knows what that should look like? And then is there some communication with the designers? Like, hey, just checking to see if this is still cool. How does that work?
All of the above. Yeah, absolutely. So with the designer, you know, with these conceptual design teams that we work with, we do establish the brand narrative, like the design concept narrative. And then actually we internally take that narrative and we transform it into an operational narrative. And that's really my job. I mean, I'm the translator, because I go through that, you know, I create the design concept and I empower the design team to bring that to life. And then I swing back around to then retranslate that design concept into a tangible, actionable brand guide, experiential guide document that is then further disseminated through our HR team. And so my job is to make sure that when we hand off this project and that we ask our team to bring it to life, that they understand the essence of the project, they understand the guardrails, the pillars, they can reference this visual and written document in a way that allows them to iterate and but to do so in a way that fits within, that nests within the concept. And so that there is communication, obviously, it's a communication problem, right? We need to communicate this brand and this vision in a way that can be easily understood.
But you actually have a brand document that you can give to your team. If people turn over, you can give it to them. And that's something you hold them to and you go back to.
100%. And then at the front end of these projects, as we're translating this concept, there's a lot of direct driving that I'm doing. There's a lot of creative collision, you know, as we translate it from a physical space to a living space. And in the first year or so of the project, we're constantly talking about, what does this mean? How are these ideas nesting within this concept? Does this feel true and right? And then there's this transitional period where the GMs, who I'm really debating this with, can, you know, take ownership of the concept, and then they're able to start making their own independent decisions. And I'm in a point now with Scott where this creative team that we have are coming up with these ideas. I didn't come up with the bar cart series. I didn't come up with some of these other programming elements. They're just doing it and they're informing me and saying, look, this is what we did. This is how it makes sense. This is why it's on brand. This is how the concept is further supported. And I'm just coming back and delighted and saying, like, this is awesome, guys. Like, music makes sense. Food nights make sense. Brunches that you're doing make sense. And it allows them to, again, be empowered and self-selecting, right? So these GMs are hungry for that.
That is awesome. I love it. But you said creative team, but I think it's really your GM, your food and beverage team. Like, you don't have some separate creative operation team that's also at the hotel in addition to the people running the hotel. It's the same team, right?
Right. It's the same team. Yeah. So it's the operational team, but they're creative. They're empowered to be a creative partner in this endeavor.
So coming out of COVID, everyone is talking about these major trends, these big things that are changing, keyless entry, all this kind of stuff. What are the big trends and things that you're thinking about over the next 5 years, if any?
Look, I think good quality service and timelessness is always on trend. Like, I think you can overcomplicate it. I think it's easy to get mired in these intricacies and try and pull on threads and come up with a new trend and do this and do that. But I think at its core, the honesty of an experience is the thing that is the most important to keep sight of. And what are the tools that you can use to leverage that? And what I mean by that is, you know, we just started doing self-check-in at High Country Motor Lodge. We have 4 self-check-in kiosks, and we have 1 front desk person who is called a guide. That person is just there to talk with you about the experiences that are available to you on property. They're not there to talk to you about how was your drive, what are you doing, and all the time filler that's required for the front desk agent to just fill the awkward spaces between handing over the credit card and checking you in. Like, that's not a value-add hospitality experience. That's just an awkward, valueless, transactional moment. And so instead, you're checking yourself in, you're making your own key card, and there's a person who's there to talk to you about the Nordic Spa and to invite you to get into the headspace of this experience and talk with you about the general store, which is our food and beverage concept that has an actual general store where you order at the counter and then the food comes out, which is, you know, indicated to you using your cell phone and other technological support infrastructure. But at the end of the day, it's like, how do you quickly order and find your seat and then have the food be brought out to you? And all we ask you for is your phone number so we can get a text message and you can either pick up the food or you can tell us where you're at. And so, you know, it's how do we layer on technology so it's additive and it's supportive of the idea of hospitality in its true essence of being convenient, being convivial, being seen, right, and being made feel special. And so we're actually, it's fun to take these little test cases and then see if they work and then roll them out. So we're actually designing right now a new concept for our hotel in Laguna. It's called Inn at Laguna Beach. And we are changing the name, relaunching the brand, and it's going to be a relatively high-rated experience. And we're going to do a self-check-in kiosk there as well. So, you know, $600-$700 night hotel with a self-check-in kiosk. We might be the first at this high end of the market to do so. Pretty confident.
Well, you're on
now
to something, because people aren't checking into a hotel to talk about the drive-in or the flight-in. They're there to talk about the experiences. And health and wellness today seems to be one of the top. Outdoors and nature seems to be up there. Is that something that you are spending a lot of time thinking about as part of your experience package?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all germane to the location. Absolutely. So wherever we can, we're just trying to be true to the experience. You know, at the Inn at Laguna Beach, we don't have room for a spa. We, of course, can bring spa experiences into your room. You know, those are hit or miss. It really depends on who your third-party spa partner is. But instead, you know, partnering with ways to get folks into the ocean, you know, stand-up paddling and otherwise. Again, these are things that are enjoyable and they are accessible, but they're not much if you don't know about them. And so if you have the opportunity while you're checking in to self-check in, to select, you know, your room and such, but then to be in a conversation with a guide to who can talk to you and learn more about what your interests might be and then direct you in a way that can be a support of what you really want out of your stay. That's really where we want to focus our training. That's where we want our team to be enhancing your stay. You know, really be curious about what you want and having the time and space for us to try and unearth that. And then, of course, you know, recording that, using content management systems to allow us to record your preferences so that, you know, you might stay with us in Laguna one time, but we know who you are when you get to Carmel. And we say, you know, we saw that you went stand-up paddling in Carmel. We don't have that here in Carmel, but we have sea kayak tours. And maybe that's something that's going to be, you know, an interesting, delightful prompt for that guest who's decided to come up to us in Carmel.
Is that something that you can actually do? Because that's very hard, but it's amazing when it's done right.
We're working on it. That's a current focus. And so that is definitely not necessarily in our infrastructure right now, but it's one of the technological leverages that we're unearthing at the moment. And, you know, it's just, how do we layer on the institutional ethos that you see at a very high quality experience, like at a Ritz-Carlton or a Four Seasons, and bring that to a bespoke kind of small, quaint inn by the sea? And, you know, it's all about punching above our weight, so to speak, and doing it thoughtfully and strategically and having a sense of entrepreneurship as part of our DNA. I think that's helpful.
I love it. It comes through. You are a master of moments. So I have a question that I want to close on with all the guests of the podcast. And it's something that I am often asked. And that is, what is your favorite hotel?
Oh, that's a good one. So I don't think I have a favorite, but I will say I had a favorite experience this last July. We went to Point Reyes for a wedding, and we stayed at Moncus Inverness Lodge. And I'm not sure if you've stayed there. It actually just sold to a consortium led by Ken Folk, but we stayed there prior to that. And the thing about that experience was it connected so deeply with the place that we were in. It was a tiny little hotel room in an old boat shed above an old boat building shop on Inverness Bay. And it was like we walked back in time. And that was beautiful by itself. But then they layered on these amazing, simple, but thoughtful hospitality elements. Most notably was the morning breakfast that arrived bundled in this beautiful wrapping of tinfoil nested within this like linen tablecloth that was rolled and put inside this kind of cast iron basin that you kind of, you know, opened and smells, and this kind of delightful experience, and a little card that talked about where it came from and why today was the day that we get to have, you know, waffles with the special honey syrup and this, that, and the other, that were all so beautifully local in nature. And I think that's really hard to do, to go to a place and experience the place in such a beautifully authentic way, is what it is that we all want to do when we're traveling. It's the most difficult promise to deliver on. And I think that one was very, very inspiring. So I would say at this stage, Moncus Inverness Lodge is a very, very special experience.
It's a vibe. I'm in. I want to go. And I think it's exciting that Ken Folk bought it. There's a lot of designers getting into the hospitality space. I wonder if their hotel friends have told them how truly complicated it is. But if it results in more experiences like you just described, let's do it.
I'm all for it.
We'll go back them. This was amazing. I thank you so much for your time and what you shared. It was really just a fabulous conversation, and I appreciate you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so honored to be part of this, and I'm so excited to see where it leads.
Hey everyone, it's Jake here. Thanks again for joining me on this conversation. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Lastly, don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Jay Wurzak. I'll see you in the next episode.
Jake Wurzak is the founder and CEO of Dove Hill Capital Management. All opinions expressed by Jake and his guests are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Dove Hill Capital Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not reflect or represent real estate, financial, or investment advice.